Plant on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Richard Gwynn joins me now. The first volume of his definitive biography of Sir John A. Macdonald has just been published. The Toronto Star columnist is also the legendary author of books on Joey Smallwood, the unlikely revolutionary, and Pierre Trudeau, the Northern Magus. His previous book, a favorite of mine, Nationalism Without Walls, was selected by the Literary Review of Canada as one of the country's 100 most important books. The first volume of John A., The Man Who Made Us, is published by Random House and retails for $37. It follows Sir John A.'s birth in Scotland through his family's arrival in Kingston, Ontario, his early career as a lawyer, to Confederation. Along the way, the author chronicles Macdonald's two marriages and captures Macdonald up to 1867, when he made us and Canada was formed. Volume 2, which will take us from 1867 to Macdonald's death in 1891, will be released in 2009. I am very pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program Richard Gwynn. Good morning, Mr. Gwynn.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Not at all. Delighted to be here.
The story of Sir John A. Macdonald, we should know that, as Americans know, say, the story of Washington or Jefferson and so on. But we don't know, I guess for the most part, Sir John A. Why don't we?
That's a good question, and it's a tough question. We have become a sort of a historical nation. Probably one of the ones in the world that pays the least attention to history. You notice it in this way, for instance. If you read American newspapers and magazines, I doubt that two or three days could go by without your finding in regular, among columnists, commentators, feature writers, and so on, some reference to something that Washington did, or Roosevelt did, or Lincoln did, or whoever did, which has some relevance to whatever subject they're dealing with. You would go months in this country before you'd find anything like that. Every year in the United States, three, four big fat books about Madison and Washington again, and Hamilton and Adams, etc., etc., Paine, come out in this country. For instance, John A. Macdonald, our most important prime minister, our first and most important by quite a margin, because no Macdonald, no Canada. The last biography on him was over half a century ago.
It was Donald Creighton's two books, right?
Donald Creighton's great two-volume books. Splendid, they are. But they are half a century old. The style is not in today's style. There's new information, different perspectives, all those changes. And it's sad. We just have decided that history is irrelevant to us. I think it's wrong because we are what we were, more than we recognize. And the way we behave now is in part, an important part, the function of our values and attributes that we had a long time ago. And it's kind of like paying no attention to your grandparents or great-grandparents and saying, well, I never met them, I never knew them, so, you know, to hell with them. Well, you are in part your grandparents, and everybody is, and your great-grandparents, and we are what we were back in the middle of the 19th century.
In preparing for this, and I've been looking forward to talking to you for a number of weeks now, a friend of mine said, well, Macdonald's been dead 1891, since 1891. What have we known? What could we possibly know about Macdonald since, say, even the Creighton books 50 years ago? What do you know, what do you find out in your books, in your work now, that's changed about Macdonald, if anything?
Well, first of all, I would say to your friend, you know, we have trapped ourselves into saying that kind of thing. That is sort of, well, we know enough, we don't need to know any more. There's always more to know about people. Views change, opinions change, facts change, and so on. One of the things, as you know from having read in the book, that which was a surprise to me, and we'll come back, I'm sure, and talk about this, but to me the most important event in Canada in the 19th century was not Confederation. Everybody takes for granted it is. It was an important event, of course it was. But the most important event that happened in Canada in the 19th century was the decision not to become American. And that was objectively a crazy decision to make. The United States was incomparably richer, more developed, had, for instance, in Manchester was just richer and had better jobs to offer. It had, for instance, an incomparably better education system than Canada and so on. And yet Canadians did not become Americans. And we could have become Americans very easily then, but no effort, simply by saying we want to become Americans. The Americans would have welcomed us in, both because of, you know, imperialism, manifest destiny, all that stuff, but also because the great Americans, including the great Thomas Jefferson, genuinely believed that Canadians needed to be and wanted to be and should be liberated from the oppressive rule of all those decaying British aristocrats. That's what how he would have seen things. And he was very disappointed the 1812 war ended without provision for Canada to join the United States. So that's one of the major discoveries I made. I mean, a whole lot about MacDonald as a man. We can talk about that as a person, as a character. But in terms of what happened in the 19th century that affects us, Canada's relationship with the United States is fundamental to our existence from the very beginning.
MacDonald's role in at Confederation, what was he steering the decision to form Canada away from America, or was he merely was he foremost in that decision, or was he sort of just steering the consensus of everyone else?
No, I mean, it's quite clear to me when you go back and look at the record that MacDonald's conversion to Confederation, he was very late joining the Confederation bandwagon, as it were, that is, taking it seriously as a proposition, he just thought it would be a waste of time before, was his realization or conviction that on the one hand you had the United States as a result of the Civil War was suddenly an incredibly powerful, energetic, confident country. It's very hard to realize, but at the start of the Civil War, 1861, the American army was 13,000, tiny. Within a bit more than a year, the army of the North alone was over a million. It was larger than Napoleon had sent into Russia. It was a staggering achievement of mobilization and all the rest of it, equipment, provisioning, and so on. And it was quite obvious to Britain that it could not defeat the United States, could not protect Canada militarily, on land. It still could at sea, the Royal Navy ruled the waves, all that stuff. And so Britain wanted to pull its troops out of North America. It had about 10,000 here protecting Canada. Because if you've got troops on one side of the border and troops on the other side of the border and the border is invisible, things can go wrong. And A leads to B leads to C and you go war. So on the one hand, MacDonald had the problem of Britain wanting to pull back from North America, pull out militarily. On the other hand, you have this incredibly energetic, confident, attractive nation south of the border. And he saw Confederation. Forget all the argument about whether Confederation was centralist or decentralist, which has obsessed our scholars ever since. He saw Confederation as a means to an end. It was a way of sending a signal of a national will to survive by these curious little colonies north of the border, sending that signal to the two places that mattered. One was London and one was Washington. And that is, in fact, what happened. And that, to me, is how he made us, by making it possible for us to remain an un-American nation in North America, an un-American nation that eventually fulfilled itself and became not an un-American nation, but a Canadian nation, which is what we are today.
How much anti-Americanism would you say MacDonald had, if any?
MacDonald himself was quite anti-American. He knew very little about the States. He did go there a number of times on holidays in his early years with business associates, but later he went exclusively either to Rue de Loup on the St. Lawrence or PEI. He only met one president during his entire term, which was extraordinarily long, you know, periods over 25 years altogether, as Prime Minister of Canada. That was Ulysses S. Grant, and they met at a reception. He was scornful of the United States. He thought their system was wrong. He thought that democracy, so-called, was in fact what they was called, in the 19th century, mobocracy. He thought that the constitutional monarch, that is someone who has sort of great influence and dignity and all that stuff, but has no power, was far superior to what he called the virtual dictator that the president was during the 4 or 8 years of his term. He just thought the British system was better, the British legal system, the British political system, the British way of life, and he was determined that we wouldn't become American. But he was at the same time a Canadian, and he has a very eloquent statement about how all his interests, all his prejudices, all his concerns are Canadian. So he was a Canadian at the same time he was British, because in his terms, and it was clearly objectively true, the only way Canada could remain un-American in the 19th century was to hang on to Britain.
How did a Scotsman do that? How did a Scotsman become enamored of the British way of life and become quintessentially Canadian?
It's very interesting. The Scots side of MacDonald is very, very interesting because, contrary to what we all think, and he was 5 years old, remember, when he came here, a boy from Glasgow, his accent was not Scottish. It was Eastern Ontario, you'd call it Prince Edward County or Bay of Quinte area. He only actually once ever went back to Scotland during the many trips he took to England. He played on being a Scot, and there were all sorts of advantages because the Scots were enormously powerful in Canada in the middle of the 19th century, both in politics, in the church, in education, and in commerce and finance. Most of the directors of the CPR, for instance, were Scots, and so on. The first two prime ministers of Canada were Scots. The first two premiers of Ontario were Scots, etc., etc., etc. But he basically came to Canada as a boy, was educated mostly by Scottish teachers. His mother spoke Gaelic, that was her first language, and so on. But he saw the British way of politics, the British way of life operating, and liked it. And by the way, another person who did that, and it's interesting, was Darcy McGee, the great Irish orator and the sort of poet laureate of Confederation, very eloquent man, who started out as an Irish, in effect, terrorist. He's a member of Young Ireland. He had to flee Ireland, disguised as a priest, came over to America, at first loved America, then decided he hated America because of slavery, and came to Canada, and then he made the extraordinary discovery that the Irish in Canada were free, were not discriminated against. And one of the amazing facts about Canada in the 19th century was that the Irish in Canada were loyal to Canada, loyal to Britain, and their cousins, and maybe their brothers, south of the border, were supporters of Irish independence, joined the Fenians who invaded Canada in order to hurt Britain. And it's a fascinating fact that there was an extraordinary degree of loyalty across Canada to the British way of doing things. That's all out of date, that's all nostalgia, but it was at the time vital for keeping Canada to go. And by the way, Joe, I just wanted to read you something because it's got a British Columbia connection.
Right.
But the best comment about the power of the British attachment among Canadians, and also a very good comment on the great difficulty after Confederation of the federal government attracting support from Canadians from coast to coast, was actually made by a British Columbia legislature called T.L. Wood, otherwise unknown, and this was around about 1870 in a debate in the little British Columbia legislature about whether they should go into Confederation. And he said this: the bond of union between Canada and the other provinces bears no resemblance to the union between England and her colonial possessions. The feeling of loyalty towards England is a blind feeling, instinctive, strong, born with us, and impossible to shake off. And loyalty to Britain, also loyalty to a whole lot of other things, loyalty to the marriage vows, loyalty to your religion, loyalty to your employer, was absolutely vital in Canada then, and it was kind of, everybody was knew you had to be seen to be loyal, and it's similarity today, and it's a way of knitting together this very disparate country that we are, this very disparate society that we are, is the way intolerance is the defining, or seen by Canadians, the defining virtue. If I can accuse you of being, you know, discriminatory, prejudiced, and so on, you're dead, basically, you know? And so you have to prove that you are tolerant, and that is the standard all Canadians hold each other to, which is wonderful. Back then, those days, 19th century, the equivalent standard was loyalty. And if I could accuse you of being disloyal, and MacDonald had a very cunning phrase, which was veiled treason. He used to accuse people he suspected of being pro-American of being guilty of veiled treason. The great cleverness about veiled treason, it's a bit like the accusation that's made against Harper that he has a hidden agenda. There's no way to prove that you haven't got a hidden agenda because you can never prove a negative. Well, loyalty was the bond that held Canadians together in the 19th century. Today, it's tolerance is our defining virtue.
What else can we learn from MacDonald's time, from MacDonald, that's contemporary today, the contemporary lesson, if you will? This relationship between French and English that he seemed to weave so well.
MacDonald invented the pattern that has absolutely dominated Canadian politics ever since, which is that of a big tent party, a party that all kinds of people can feel pretty comfortable with. And he pulled in Francophones, as you said. He pulled in what he called progressive conservatives. He was the first to use that phrase. And he was very hostile to the high Tories, who were too far to the right, and so on. And he produced, his favorite political word was moderation. He developed a centrist big tent party, for which the founding basis was an alliance between French and English. And that model has defined our politics ever since. What happened, of course, at a certain point was the Liberals displaced the Conservatives, and the Liberals became the governing party, and have been that until the last, half dozen years or so. And they're now under serious challenge, as we all know. And the one problem with a centrist, non-ideological party, which can therefore believe in almost anything, is that how do you hold it together? How do you bond people to it? If it's an ideological party, whether of the right or the left, if you are a member of the right, then you will be building New Jerusalem. If you go to work for that party, or a member of the left, you'll be building your version of New Jerusalem. If it's a non-ideological party, which is what we have, what binds you to it? And the answer is patronage. And MacDonald, the patronage preceded him. Patronage is as old as Canada, it's as old as Canadian as maple syrup. But he used patronage in a calculated way to build a party. He didn't just reward conservatives. He made conservatives. He attracted people into the party by the promise eventually of rewards of one kind or another. And patronage has been a major feature of Canadian politics from our very beginning. And as we all know from the sponsorship scandal, is still so today.
How much of the patronage, though, do you think is became corruption for MacDonald?
Of course it did. Of course it did. You're absolutely right, Joe. It wasn't personal corruption. MacDonald, as far as anybody knows, never took a cent himself. He didn't enrich himself personally. And in fact, at one time, not long after Confederation, he was, for all practical purposes, bankrupt because of problems with his law firm. But there is no doubt that he took money from business people to fund the Conservative Party. There's no doubt that he allowed corruption, and that's one of the great strikes against the founder of the country. You would like the founder of your country not to have been so lax about corruption.
A lot, Richard, has been said of MacDonald's drinking, mm-hmm. and his alcoholism. Did you find that was really as a big deal as it was? In your research of him?
Well, it was a big deal in the sense that he was a particular kind of drinker. He was a binge drinker. And he would not drink for months, and then he would go on a bat and get, and it could be at a time when there were terribly important decisions to be made, and he would be blotto. The way he was different from drinking today, social drinking, which is, like having a glass or two of wine, a bottle of beer, that kind of thing in the evening, didn't exist. When you started drinking, you got drunk. What was extraordinary about MacDonald was he made no apology for this. He showed no shame of it. There's a famous story of him on the platform in an election, an all candidates meeting, and his opponent is speaking, and in the middle of it, MacDonald had been drinking, heaves up on stage, in public. The worst thing you could possibly do, you're dead politically. What does MacDonald do? He turns to the audience, and he says, "I'm terribly sorry. I don't know why it is, but whenever my opponent speaks, I lose my stomach." Well, what can you do, It's sort of like Bill Clinton, whose sins we all know, and in the end you sort of forgive him because there's a kind of bad boy quality about him. MacDonald, by the way, Joe, was the first Canadian politician to use humor. MacDonald was wonderful. He could tell stories, of course, marvelously. He was a great mimic, but he was also very fast on his feet. And he always could, you could never top him. There was another occasion on a campaign He's addressing a bunch of farmers. He clambers onto a piece of farm machinery to better address them. And one farmer points out, "Excuse me, Sir John, you're standing on a manure spreader." And McDonald says, "This is the first time I've ever stood on the Liberal platform." Again, what could you do except shrug it and say he won that round?
It seems to me that you've had some fondness for McDonald, do you?
I had an enormous amount of fun. He's a fascinating man. He is a very complex man. He's not at all, the corrupt, cynic, drunk, this kind of thing. That's true, but it's all superficial and shallow. I mean, let me just give you one example. This is not in this book. It occurred in the 1880s. He was once asked which religion he most admired. McDonald was not religious himself, like public figures, and he went to service on Sundays. But, and I bet you wouldn't get it right. I bet you none of your listeners or anyone reading the blog would get it right. I didn't get it right. The answer was the Salvation Army. Because the Salvation Army was doing enormously important work amongst the poor, who were now growing in number as the cities grew, and urban workers are vulnerable in a way, which were an economic downturn, in a way that farmers, who can fall back on their own food, their own, firewood, all this kind of thing, are not. And so for a crusty old conservative to pick the Salvation Army, he was constantly surprised by his complexity.
I'm assuming that Salvation Army anecdote, that'll be in your
story. That'll be in Vol 2.
Yeah, how are you doing on that? Have you finished that yet?
No, I haven't finished it, I haven't started. I mean, I started the research, but I'm exhausted. This is a huge project. This took me 3 years of very intense work, and I need a break.
And how have you reacted to the reviews of Volume 1?
The reviews of Volume 1 have been very, very good, with one exception. That was one of the standard tiresome things of an academic historian who basically doesn't want non-historians to write history books. Well, he's got to grow up and smell the coffee. Most history books now are not written by historians, by the way, professional historians. Anyway, the others were very, very good, and I've been delighted. And I've had very good feedback from people who read the book, because unfortunately, if we go back to your first question, why are we turned off history? There's kind of an assumption that history is dull. It's not dull. It's about people. It's about people in public. It's performing in public. It's about people making the best of bad situations, or making mistakes and then trying to rectify them. And so you get an insight into human character. And McDonald, one of his great virtues as a politician, was he always started from the individual and the individual's character. And what he wasn't looking at an opponent who was premier, like he had a big fight with the Ontario premier, Oliver Mowat, for many years. But what kind of a guy was he? What impelled him to behave in this way? And so on. And he was a wonderful judge of human nature and very accepting of people's faults and foibles and flaws and so on. Typical example of McDonald, one of his cabinet ministers once committed the terrible, terrible social offense of marrying a divorced woman. And this basically made him a pariah in society. And McDonald's comment when he was told about his cabinet minister's behavior, going off to get married to this divorced woman, was, "There is no wisdom below the belt." He just took life as it came. He understood life as life.
Did you think that, suppose McDonald came back today, how would he feel about the country that we have today?
Well, he would feel very pleased, because the most essential thing has happened, which I tried to say earlier, that we're not just now an un-American nation, we're a Canadian nation. With its faults and its attributes and successes. Things are going pretty well at the moment. They're no doubt not going not so well in X number of years. That's life. That's the cycle of life. So he would have been very pleased with the basic format that has happened. He would of course be staggered by all the changes, and some he would regard as good and some he would regard as bad. I mean, we tend to assume that we are so much better than the people in the 19th century, that we have learned and we're wiser and more sensitive and more caring and more inclusive and all those things. One of the things that would shock McDonald about contemporary Canada is the fact that aging parents are in effect warehoused in apartments or condos or old people's homes or nursing homes. In his day, it was quite normal for aging parents to spend their last years, their last decades, with their grown-up children. And there is, by the way, which I quote, a wonderful footnote, what I regard as the best footnote in Canadian history, written by a historian who gave me a lot of help. His name is Keith Johnson. But when MacDonald married his second wife, Agnes Bernard, as she was, her mother moved in with them, and her brother-in-law moved in with him. They believed in the extended family. And Keith Johnson, who was writing a book about letters between the MacDonald family, said that John A. MacDonald had in-laws like other people have mice.
Richard, finally, are you hopeful that with this book, and there have been a number of books on MacDonald in recent years, a couple of books, including a work of fiction, that your motivation to write this book, that history be taught more or learned more, do you think that's been fulfilled at all?
Well, my dearest hope is that young people will pick out the book with great reluctance and suspicion, boring old history, and say, discover themselves saying, hey, this is interesting. I can relate to this. I can understand what's going on. And I really hope that happens, because the book is a good read. It is lively. It is human, you know, and so on. And another group that I hope read this kind of book are immigrants. I mean, if they want to find out about what is now their country, this book describing how we started and the kind of people we once were and the relationship between the way we once were and the way we now are is a pretty good introduction to this country. And so I hope that some immigrants will pick up the book and start off again by saying, who cares about what happened in 19th century Canada? All I care about is, you know, what's happening down the street. And then start find themselves saying, no, I understand how this curious country, which is so diverse and so spread out, and all those obvious problems that we have, has yet probably evolved the most successful multiculturalism program in the world. I'm pretty sure we have. It's tough, it's not easy, but we're doing it, and we're doing it pretty damn well. And it was in part because of the way we were. In those days, way, way back, there were huge divisions and suspicions and even hatreds between religions, and of course between the French and English. And there is a wonderful comment where people think everything is new by a very good journalist of the time called Goldwin Smith, who was very critical about MacDonald for his acceptance of corruption, but he praised him as being able to hold together a set of elements, I'm now quoting, hold together a set of elements, national, religious, sectional, and personal, as motley as the component patches of any crazy quilt, and actuated each of them by paramount regard for its own interest, end quote. And that, to me, was a perfect description of Canada then and of Canada now, and of what MacDonald's contribution was. He had the political wit, nerve, skill, instincts to herd cats, and that's what he did.
Indeed, Richard, and it's been delightful to have you on. I do suggest that people buy the book. It is a remarkable and necessary read. And I thank you again, Richard, for coming on today and talking about this book, and we'll look forward to Volume 2.
Joe, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
The book is called John A., The Man Who Made Us, The Life and Times of John A. MacDonald, Volume 1, 1815 to 1867, $37 from Random House, but you probably get it cheaper now because it's a bestseller online or at bookstores, etc. For The Commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.